In this episode, we wait out there with Phil Torella from Colorado Springs, Colorado. Phil grew up hitting the South Platte River and teaching his teammates about catching trout on the fly in between hockey practices. After his hockey career, he returned to Colorado and began guiding through college, eventually becoming a full-time guide and author. We discuss the Dream Stream section of the South Platte River, tactics and techniques for chasing big brown trout, and Phil's new book, The Fly Fisher's Guide to Colorado's Easy Access Lakes. Welcome to the Wade Out There Fly Fishing Podcast. I'm your host, Jason Shemchuk. At Wade Out There, we believe fly fishing is special, but not elite, and that anyone can become a great fly fisher if they are willing to go, learn, and teach. Join me as I talk with other fly fishermen and women about their unique journeys into fly fishing, the rivers they fish, and the tactics and philosophies they practice. For those who can never leave the river in their hearts, this podcast is dedicated to helping you make the memories that keep us all coming back to Wade Out There. Welcome, Phil. Thanks for being on the Wade Out There podcast. I'm really excited to talk to you today.
Yeah, absolutely, Jason. Thank you so much for having me. And really looking forward to talking about fly fishing. So,
yeah, it turns out I like to talk about fly fishing, and I figured you would like to as well. So, I'm excited to talk to you because your home waters, we're going to talk about the South Platte today, and it's kind of the place that you grew up fly fishing a lot, and it's where you fly fish a lot today. But also, I have a little bit more in common with you than I thought. I mean, I know you come from an Air Force family, and I was in the Air Force. And did you go to UNC? Is that right?
Yeah, University of Northern Colorado up there. So
you played hockey for him too, right?
Yeah, club hockey there. So I grew up playing hockey, and after a little bit of stint playing juniors in Canada and Minnesota for a little bit, ended up hanging up the competitive skates and would rather go drink a couple beers and snap the puck around a little bit. So
that makes sense. I like beer too, so that's good. But my wife went to UNC, and so when I was in school, the South Platte was closer to where I was at, but once we started dating, I was up there quite a bit, as you can imagine.
I'm sorry to hear that.
No, it's great. It's 4-1 girl to guy up there is what I was always told. So, but and I would always go up and fish the Big Thompson. I'm curious, did you ever go up that way? I felt like that was my closest straight line trout stream was
we fished the Big Thompson quite a bit. It's just such a quick, easy trip. We'd be in the Big Thompson Canyon there in 20 minutes, and that was fun. We'd shoot over and fish the Cache the Pooter there right in Fort Collins. Actually a phenomenal fishery right in town there, and then spent a lot of days driving up into Wyoming and fishing the North Platte as well. So
yeah, that's cool, man. I just when I saw UNC, I'm like, oh man, I wonder how much time he spent on the Big Thompson, because same reason, just easy to get to, and I thought it was fun. I never caught any big fish, but I also was not. I was pretty much beginner level, but I don't know. It was a fun fishery, I thought, and it's real pretty and lots of access.
Awesome little river coming through there for sure.
But now you grew up mostly fishing the South Platte, and now you're kind of back in that area. Mm-hmm. So I'm curious. I was going to ask you, I read that you had a break from fly fishing where you were doing hockey, and did that influence your decision to kind of get into fly fishing, more professionally or full time or something like that?
Yeah. So the way it kind of worked, I growing up in Colorado Springs here, I basically was playing hockey or fishing. If you had asked, 14 or 15 or 16 year old Phil what I was going to do with my life, I was absolutely going to the NHL. No question about it. Right.
Right.
Growing up and, playing high level hockey here in Colorado, I think when I was 17, I think I was one of three guys on our team from Colorado. Everyone else was, you know, had moved out here and was living with a host family or a billet family. So I had a lot of young men on my team that were from Dallas and Chicago and California and all that.
Is this in high school?
This was during high school. Yeah.
That's incredible. Like, I'm going to send my kid to Colorado to play high school.
It's pretty neat. You know, once you kind of start figuring out is that one kind of be your goal and kind of progress further in a career in hockey, it's kind of what these kids are doing now. Now they're leaving even earlier now, like 14 years old, 13 years old. They're going and living with other families and playing hockey, home. And, but
that's incredible. I can't even imagine that.
That's wild. Crazy commitment for sure.
Yeah.
But because I had a lot of these guys on my team, and some of them, you know, obviously it would be, especially during our hockey season, kind of September through, I guess, March, is when the bulk of them would be living here in Colorado Springs and, you know, we'd be practicing and playing every day. But a handful of them would stick around during the summer months to train. So we'd still train, but whether it was an afternoon training session or a morning training session, there was always that opportunity to, you know, go fish either before our training or after. And I was pretty much going every day, during the summer, again, either before or after. And a couple of my buddies on my team, you know, became inquisitive and started asking if they could come with me. And I was like, yeah, man, let's go. And, so yeah, I think when I was like 17, 18 years old and started teaching, you know, I was teaching my buddies, at least how I was doing it and, you know, what was going on. That was really, really cool. And I really loved doing that, and begin to, you know, see their success and be a part of that was super cool. And then, yeah, when I was, 18, like I said, spent a little bit of time in, Kelowna, British Columbia, Canada, playing juniors, and then finished that season off in Owatonna, Minnesota, playing juniors, before I decided to hang up the skates. At that point, obviously, you're young and you're a little bit more full of pride. I didn't think I was getting a fair shake when, you know, looking back in reality, you just weren't good enough, man. you didn't have that level. And, so the writing was kind of on the wall that, you know, whether I played another season of juniors or not, my hockey career was going to kind of be done. So,
but you went out on your turn. You say, well, I'm done.
Yeah, I did. I went out on my terms and ended up, yeah, came back to Colorado, enrolled at UNC at Northern Colorado there. And after my freshman year is when I began guiding full time on the South Platte. So,
from UNC, you'd go down there.
Yeah. I mean, you know, and like my parents still lived in the Springs. So
right. It
was, if I needed to, you know, crash at their place or whatever to, you know, be ready for a trip the next day. And to be honest too, like, you know, I was pretty upfront and talked with all my professors and my teachers and told them, hey, if you want me to afford to be able to go to school here, I'm going to have to miss some days so I can work, which I think they appreciated. There may or may not have been a couple days that I was supposed to be working that I may have been in Wyoming fishing too. But,
well, that's part of the journey. It's part of the fly fishing journey. And
that's
the
right.
Work.
That's right.
So. Hey, you know, the other part of that, well, I can see where they would appreciate that because it's not like, well, this guy's not showing up to class because he's just,
right,
you know, he's just out partying and drinking. And
exactly. You
know,
yeah.
Like, it's a whole different thing when you say, listen, I'm going to work, you know?
Right. Well, and I told him, I mean, and I you know, I'll be honest, I took a lot of pride in, how I did in school, and which I think more than anything was a product of me taking a couple years off between high school and college. And it was a decision to go back to school.
Like a purposeful, like,
right.
I want a skill set.
It wasn't
this.
The next step, after high school that I think a lot of kids kind of get sucked into, like, oh, next step is college. And, you know, so yeah. I mean, I had a great time in school. Don't get me wrong. Yeah. I had my fair share of fun, but I did really well and, took pride in how hard I worked. And, so I think that kind of combination and being upfront with my professors kind of set me up for success in that manner. So,
yeah, I couldn't agree more. I think that's, you know, I think college with purpose is different than just the next step, you know, and you kind of take it for granted a little bit if it's just the next step. But
sure,
I don't know. I didn't have those issues. I you know, I was just join the military and off you go. So, did you miss fly fishing like when you're playing hockey a lot, or was it like I'm just super focused on this goal?
No,
or was it like I don't know? Maybe I'll go back and do this other thing and then.
Well, I did. And again, this is when I was, you know, 18, 19 years old, 17, 18, 19 years old. So, I hadn't quite figured out what I was going to be doing yet. But I definitely missed it. I do remember, you know, being in the basement of my billet house, in Minnesota, and, you know, I had my vise there and I was spinning flies pretty much every day after practice. And that's pretty much all I did afterwards. So it was, yeah, I mean, it was always with me, and I was always, you know, keeping tabs on fishing reports and
fishing reports,
you know,
yeah,
all that stuff. And this is, you know, pre Instagram and quite frankly pre Facebook. So, you know, there really wasn't, you know, you'd have to look online and be like, oh, what's going on at Deckers or the Dream or what's going on back home kind of thing. So,
yeah, I did a lot of that when I was in the Air Force. Just why am I, in hindsight, I don't know what I was doing, but I guess I was always thinking or planning about a trip. Like, right. when I get back, I'll take a trip up the canyon, or I'll maybe go out on the Yakima with my brother when I'm in Washington, or, nice. You know, and I'm trying to check things out. But I didn't tie flies, and I always, for folks that don't get to go as often as they like, I think that's a great thing to keep you kind of connected to fly fishing when you're not able to get to the river as often as you like.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. You want to talk a little bit more about the South Platte? Because, you know, obviously that seems like a special river to you. And I'm curious, is it special because you started on it or guiding or all the above? Or why do you particularly enjoy the South Platte?
Yeah, kind of all of the above. You know, I remember, you know, when I was 8, 9 years old and, you know, I didn't have waders or, and, you know, I think I had like a Walmart brand, you know, fishing fly rod. And, I was just out there, had a, you know, my parents still have the picture of it. You know, got a buzz cut, just, you know, just straight down. I'm just out there slinging it, have no idea what's going on, but, you know, oh man, this is, you know, everything I've ever heard is South Platte's like the best river ever.
The Dream Stream.
Yeah.
Even though I can never catch fish on it when I go up there. But when I was starting out, I do better now, but
good. Well, then you'll have to come back and we'll have to go fish it. So,
come out and prove it.
Yeah. But yeah, man, it's, when I was 10, I finally caught my first brown trout on a brassy, a little brassy midge, right there about quarter mile upstream of the Deckers Bridge. And I just thought that was the coolest thing ever. And you know, it was so cool to have that kind of right there. And you know, when you're a kid, and I was always that kid, you kind of get up to the river and your eyes just light up, right? Because you really, you know, I guess it's still the same way. You don't know what kind of the day's gonna hold, but that anticipation when you're a kid of like even catching one fish is, you know, so awesome. And then, yeah, just spent a lot of time, you know, at Deckers. That's where my stepdad would take me, and, you know, that's where he was familiar with. So that's where he'd take me. And my stepdad didn't fly fish or anything like that, but, you know, that's where he liked to go. So that's where we would go. And then when I got my driver's license when I was 16, My first car was a 1989 baby blue Mazda MPV minivan. So rear wheel drive, just awesome.
Perfect for Colorado.
Oh yeah, great Colorado car, right? So you know, I'm 16 and I'm just buzzing up that dirt road in 11 Mile Canyon every chance I can get. you know,
fishtailing.
Oh yeah, just drifting around the corners. It was my own personal little rally road in that garden. You know, young and dumb. Yeah. But I was the kid that you'd see on the bank getting a tangle out, and you know, I'd get up there as soon as I could and stay as late as I could. And
what kept you going? I'm always curious, like when you're not catching fish in the beginning, or you're not as, you know, you don't have as many skill sets or whatever, like what kept you interested or going? You know, you have all these other things pulling you, and you got hockey is a big one, but then you've got, you know, school and the opposite sex and things like that. Like what's bringing Phil back when you're not even catching that many fish?
Oh man, to be honest, it's just for me, just being out and trying to figure it out, right? I think for me, the puzzle, it's always the puzzle of trying to figure it out. And it's just kind of, you know, it's for me, it truly is the most addicting thing. I could never get enough of it. You'd hook a fish and you'd lose it and be like, oh man, you know, all right, what did I do? And, you know, I'd kind of backtrack and, you know, keep a journal even. And if I caught one fish, like everything about that fish was going in my journal as far as water conditions, weather that day, a little map on where I caught it. So, you know, especially when I was like 11, I'd draw little maps and be like, okay, there's a fish that lives in that spot. So I know where that one is, so I can go catch that one. You know, but just kind of the puzzle and trying to figure it out day after day. And, you know, you start to see yourself progress more and more as well. And even little progressions kind of makes you a little bit more confident here and there. And, I mean, that's the big thing. So.
Yeah. Progress. I think that's huge. That's for me, that's what I love about fly fishing is making progress and mm-hmm. seeing progress. And it's not the same to catch a fish, like to go into the fly shop here's this fly, go to this place and cast and catch a fish. It's not the same as fishing a river for a while and then mm-hmm. like figuring something out and it works, you know,
right.
Whether it's a small thing or, you know, or a big thing, like a big realization for me was just how important a natural drift was. Like, I don't understand how I didn't know that for so long, but like becoming like, you know, just militant about having a natural drift, like, and figuring little things out and bigger things. I think for me, I agree. Just solving problems, puzzles, things like that. Do you have a favorite section of the South Platte that you like to go to, or has that changed as you've been younger and older?
Yeah. I mean, you know, it kind of changed when I started getting a little bit older and a little bit, I felt a little bit more confident in my abilities. You know, originally my first few trips to the Dream Stream were, you know, they were bad when I was younger. Yeah. I had no idea what was going on.
It's just a tough, tough fishery. I mean, there's hardly any cover. It's windy a lot. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Like, you know, it's just the fish get pressure. It's, I don't know.
Yeah. Okay. But now I mean, I absolutely love the Dream. You know, I've really built my career there the last 14 years. I probably spend more time on that river than I do anywhere else, both with guiding and personal days. So, you know, getting to become super familiar with that river and, you know, just the fish that are there, their food sources, what they, their behaviors as well. And, you know, recognizing just small things, little changes of migration or where they'll move when a bump and flow happens, this, that, or the other, just some different change in conditions and kind of learning over time where they're going to be or what they're going to, you know, hopefully be feeding on. I think the Dream is probably these days, it's my favorite. It was a tough year there this year.
Just
lots of different factors kind of going against the fishery itself, but all in all, yeah, it's a great place. And I love being in South Park and, you know, being out there in the valley is just awesome. So
how have you seen it change through the years since when you started fishing it? Not just your journey, but just the river and then, you know, the folks that go out to fish it.
Yeah. You know, it's, I think pressure has played a huge role. Some natural occurrences have played a huge role in what, especially this year, I think was kind of a little bit of a tipping point. Last year we had a flash flood event, and the inlet was fairly filled in with sediment. So we have, you know, this spring we had a pretty dismal migration of rainbows and cutthroats and cutbows. This fall, well, we got kokanee salmon and a handful of lake run browns, you know, certainly not the numbers that we used to see a decade ago. You know, I know that the limited travel lane for those fish to come in and out of the reservoir is dwindled a little bit, so it's not as easy for them to come in. I do believe over the years that pressure during especially those spawning seasons has, you know, wised some of those, you know, large adult fish that come year after year into, you know, either migrating up above the fence where people can't get to them, or just choosing to swim in the reservoir and spawn in the reservoir, which makes it tough because then we don't get we kind of year over the course of the year, you know, we rely on those migratory fish. Everybody, a lot of people know about the spring and fall migrations, and that's kind of your best time. But for those of us that guide it 12 months a year, you know, we kind of rely on migratory fish coming into the river during the summer months and sticking around during the winter months. And,
yeah, cause you're guiding all year long. So,
right. So, you know, it kind of, you know, to be honest, it felt like I was picking on the same 20 to 30 fish all summer and, you know, have to pick a section to, you know, all right, I got this guy yesterday, not mess with him today, and kind of thing. And, you know, you still go and have a great day and, you know, it'd be a lot of fun. And, you know, those random new fish that would show up were, you know, were fantastic. And, you know, I think when we found those, I'd get more excited than the folks, cause they just, you know, it was a great fish, but they didn't realize that, oh my goodness. Like,
yeah, they're not seeing it all.
You know what I mean? So, I think that's one of the biggest things. And then just year after year, the pressure in the spring and the fall, you know, I guess my best example is, 2 weeks ago, one of my longest running clients, he, you know, we walked around and, you know, we aren't seeing a ton of fish, and said, man, Phil, that's so much different than from 10 years ago. I'm like, I know, man, it's, yeah, there's just fewer fish in the river and fewer fish migrating in right now. So, so it was a tough one, kind of a tough pill to swallow this year, just seeing it in its condition. And like I said, we had some fantastic days and, you know, right, got some awesome fish and had great dry fly eats and all the above that, you know, kind of make for such a, that kind of really do give it its name and its description, but, just not quite what it used to be. So
what advice do you have for folks that are new to fly fishing or new to the area that come to fish that? And cause I've always thought about this, you know, the guides are up there all the time, mm-hmm, and they obviously have a vested interest in the health and population of the species. But, you know, so that includes, I mean, the fly shops don't just close their doors during spawning season.
Right.
So you know, and I've heard arguments about like, well, I don't fish during the spawn, and you know, and when I was a kid, like really young out in Montana as a teenager, I didn't know about reds or any of that stuff at all.
Right.
So how do you fish around the spawn and still be, you know, healthy, or a steward of the stream, you know, and not, sure, force these fish into other places? Because I don't know, to me, it can be a little, other than like, if you see if this is a red, don't, mm-hmm, bother the fish on the red. But like, is there other things that you can do besides not targeting a fish on a red?
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly the biggest one, is, you know, just not targeting those fish. Because for me, when you do target those fish on a red, if you end up hooking them in the mouth, it's not because they ate your fly. It's a defense. It's much more of a defense. You didn't fool that fish into eating. But also the big problem that we see a lot of when people are targeting those fish on spawning beds is they, because it's such a large bodied fish and you're nymphing, and because reds are in fairly shallow water, if that fish does not eat your fly, you end up hanging your flies on that fish. You end up snagging that fish, foul hooking that fish. The amount of energy and calories burnt and the body mass that these fish lose over the course of their spawning season, just from that ritual itself, is so great that when you foul hook one of these fish and you are, you know, pulling them in, you know, tail first or from right. the side, like that's when, you know, a day or two later you find that fish, you know, dead in the grass somewhere. So, obviously, yeah, definitely not targeting those fish, but also just being careful where you walk, you know, you know, if you're going to cross the river and you're near reds, and again, I know they're in shallow water, so.
Yeah. So it's like, oh, it's shallow. I'm going to cross here. Or
it's in a spot that you would want to cross. So if you do need to cross in those sections, you know, making sure that you're crossing maybe above those reds rather than below. Because when the female drops her eggs, they may not all land directly in that red. Some may drift downstream a little bit. So trying to cross above the reds a little bit rather than, you know, below them, and certainly not right on top of them.
Yeah.
Is probably the best advice there.
So fishing to a trout, like, you know, just before or just after, like, cause I'm always thinking, well, he's not spawning on the red now, but maybe, like, I don't know, if I came back in an hour or two, he'd move mm-hmm. up to some place that, you know, maybe I haven't identified a red yet or something like that. Is it fair game to fish to, you know, a trout that is not, you know, I don't see a red, like there's fish, especially on the Dream Stream or,
right.
you know, the South Platte where there's so much sight fishing.
Mm-hmm.
I think there is, I don't know. Is that,
no, there, yeah, I definitely understand. So, you know, the way I teach my clients and how we go about our day is, we just fish deep water looking for feeding fish. You know, if we're there could, because there's been other instances where, you know, I got scared for this fish one time because we were walking along, and I mean, this was, you know, your 28, 30 inch, incredibly thick, just bright orange male brown. He wasn't on a red. He wasn't in a run. He was just sitting on the bottom of this shallow little eddy. And my client was like, oh, let's cast him. And that AF fish is not eating. If you put your flies along that fish, you're just going to snag him. You know, so like that fish for me was not fair game. That fish was either, you know, taking a break from what they were doing or, you know, yeah. in bad shape already from something else.
Yeah. See, those are the nuances that are tricky, you know?
Right. You know, so, I mean, that fish was the only reason that fish was even sitting there with people walking past him was not because he was eating. I mean, and again, you know, you could see him as clearly as I'm seeing you right now. I mean, he was across the table from me as far as distance goes, yeah. you know, not moving, not eating, just kind of sitting there. So,
yeah, so sportsmanship kind of is out of it anyway, you know. It's like shooting ducks on the water, kind of.
Right. Yeah.
They're just sitting there, man. I mean,
yeah. So, you know, we'll go fish those deeper runs and, you know, look for those more actively feeding fish that are, you know, going to be sitting in the runs and you know, are trying to kind of fuel up a little bit more. You know, and in that case, those are the fish we're going to target. We're not going to target those fish that are actively spawning or yeah. you know, those fish that are just kind of resting on the river's edge. So
yeah, deeper water, I think that's mm-hmm. certainly useful because there's not much spawning going on in those types of areas. So
right, I mean, and it can happen for sure, and like there's, you know, you'll find some deeper water reds, but and the problem there is just a lot of times they'll build their reds in a shallow riffle and they'll continue to go back to them even if they raise the water level. So they're a little tougher to distinguish or see. I pretty much, to be honest, unless it's a rainbow, I try not to, unless it's a rainbow and, you know, early in the season when fish are pre-spawn and there really aren't any spawning beds around, you know, if I see a brown or a riffle and, you know, he's not on a, you know, an obvious spawning bed or any type of thing that looks like it could be construed as a spawning bed, we'll cast to that fish. But once there's spawning beds in the river, I pretty much, unless it's a rainbow and I can clearly make out it's a rainbow, I don't even really worry about the riffles. So
because they're, yeah, that's what's going on in that.
Yeah, the odds are, yeah, if there's a 30-inch brown trout in a riffle, you know, on the Dream Stream in the middle of October, it's there for a purpose and it's not to feed. So
right, it's not the same as a 30-inch brown trout in shallow water on the Bighorn in August or something.
Exactly. You know? Right.
Because, yeah. Okay. That's fair enough. As you were fishing it throughout your years, do you remember any particular tactic or technique that kind of was a light bulb for you that after you learned that you kind of said, oh man, and then really progressed on that river?
Yeah. You know, I think, one of the biggest things, it was more involved in sight fishing and quite kind of just looking for fish and taking time to look for fish there. You know, it's in my opinion, I kind of have always, and it's not exact by any means, but I'll say that like 70% of the fish are in 30% of the water. Meaning that you can go and work a fishy looking run and literally be 10 feet away from, you know, the biggest trout that you'll find there. Just because that fish is either in front of a rock, at the top of the run, or, you know, hiding in a little sneaky spot where it doesn't look as fishy as maybe one of those deeper runs. So kind of just for me, taking the time to really learn where those fish are going to be, as far as kind of their more sneaky spots and looking in front of rocks rather than kind of in the deeper runs is kind of, they're very structure oriented again, because it's such a migratory river. You know, these are a lot of those fish that spend a lot of time in a very deep lake, where they don't have people walking all over them all day, every day. So, yeah, you know, they really enjoy being around structure. They feel safer and will feed a little bit more heavy, I guess, with, when they feel safe. You know, if they eat and feel, get a little spooked, they can just, you know, shoot underneath that rock right there. That's kind of,
or if they hook up, then you can,
then they're
rub up against it.
Yeah. Yep, it's exactly right.
What's the balance between sight fishing and, you know, getting too close to where, okay, that looks like you said, a fishy run or a fishy mm-hmm. spot, and I want to look for the fish, but, you know, as I move up, you know, these guys are hard to see, you know? And so do you ever say that looks good, but I'm going to cast further out, because I think that there's a fish in there. I mean, I'm imagining the Dream Stream in particular, because like, it seems so tricky for me personally to kind of like navigate, and it's so windy and stuff. So I was just wondering what your thoughts are on that balance.
Yeah. I mean, and you know, you certainly will have your days there where, you know, the clarity isn't perfect, or, you know, maybe you have a weird sky day where you have the crazy reflection of the clouds bouncing off the water and, you know, it's just near impossible to see anything. You know, in those cases, I guess, you know, fishing there for as long as I have and guiding there 14 years, it's, you know, I kind of learned. So, you know, for me now, and especially when I'm with clients, it's all right, a fish should be in that spot. Let's see if he's there. We'll give it, you know, 20 or 30 drifts, change bugs, 20 or 30 more drifts. Okay. He's either there or he's not usually. And okay, we'll move on. So, and when you can't see, you know, it's more about kind of just picking the water apart. You know, again, that's kind of, you know, if I'm going to a new spot, for example, like, so if I were going to another river that I didn't have the knowledge on, and I'm not in conditions that allow me to see fish easily, it's working those, you know, fishier zones. I mean, you still have to work those fishy zones because that's where those fish are going to be. So
yeah, cast a little further out or show a little more, but it's about like, it's also balanced for me too, because, you know, the more line I get out, the less natural my drift is. And
right.
I'm really trying to keep, I personally don't like as much line on the water because I end up not being able to mend as well and keep it looking good, especially on a technical river like the Dreamstream, where that's super, super important. So
yeah, I mean, like on that note, that's something that I teach a lot of my clients, especially during trico time, when you do kind of have to have that very natural dead drift of the spent spinners. You know, I have a lot of folks that'll come out, we'll see a riser, and sure enough, that fly ends up landing 30 feet above that trout. And, you know, by the time the fly gets to the fish, there's just, you know, every single little micro current in the river has done something to our fly. So, you know, that fish is already looking up, he's sipping spinners. So especially with a small trico, the closer you can kind of get it, I tell my clients, you know, a foot to 2 feet in front of a rising fish when we're fishing trichos, especially in close quarters like that. I understand there's situations where that's not always a possibility, but yeah, when you're fishing those spent spinners during trico time, and you do have to have that, you know, 100% natural dead drift because those fish are eating dead bugs that are not moving at all. The less time that fly is on the water in front of that fish, the less opportunity the current or various little microcurrents have to mess with your line and move your line. You know, if you can lay that 2 feet above, throw one little quick mend or just make one quick little adjustment, that fly is going to be perfect as it gets to the fish.
Yeah.
So
it's a balance there too, of like how long does it see it? And then, but how natural is it too?
Right.
You know, yeah, trichos are tricky little flies, yeah, to get out there and fish. What is a trico, like, let's say, absent of hatches, is there a couple flies that a beginner or moderate skilled fly tier, such as myself, maybe more below average, would be able to tie to take out there that you would say, yeah, these would be decent flies to, if you were coming out to fish with?
Yeah, pheasant tails. I mean, there's a million different patterns and new patterns come out every single year. And, you know, yeah, I'm fortunate I've got a couple patterns now with Montana Fly Company. And, you know, it's great that all these different patterns, but, you know, a size 16, 18 or 20 pheasant tail.
Yeah.
That's if I'm having to work for fish, that usually ends up on my rig because that's, you know, quite frankly, it's a proven performer for years and years and years. And,
yeah. And every time I turn a rock over, people say, oh yeah, like turn rocks over and check out the bugs and stuff, you know, and I do that.
Look at all these different sized pheasant tails on the bottom of this rock.
Yes, they all look just like a little tiny pheasant tail.
Right.
I don't really know why I'm turning these rocks over. I'm just going to find little bugs that look like pheasant tails.
Right.
But no, I mean, oversimplifying it to make a joke there. But yeah, okay, that's a good one, man. That's definitely a fairly easy tie. I can tie it, so
yeah, yeah, you
can't know, be that hard.
Especially for people, you know, I like pheasant tails for especially like earlier beginner novice type tires, because there are a lot of steps to it, and you do have to kind of, you know, try to get your proportions right, and you use more than one material. It's not a San Juan worm where it's thread and chenille. Yeah. You know, it's a good fly to kind of build skills on. So it works. So if you can spin up a bunch of those, that's gonna definitely be a benefit to you, especially out there. So
I always say the best thing that you can do, this is my opinion based on my experience, but the best thing that I did to up my fly tying game was tie flies that I caught fish with. Like,
yeah,
once you start doing that, then it's like, oh man, this is awesome. I love tying flies now. I'll go to the vice more often now. And but then they got to be simple for me to knock out enough with my skill set to get them out there. What's something that you learned on the South Platte recently? I know you've been out there a long time, but maybe something you relearned. And then got just a couple more questions on the South Platte.
Yeah. You know, I think more than anything, it can be both an incredibly technical tailwater where perfect drifts are absolutely required. And then other times they're just fish that are hungry and want to eat food. You know, it's one of those days where like, it was that trip this summer. You know, you're teaching and your clients are doing a great job and they're hooking some fish and, getting into fish, and all of a sudden, you know, just fish start eating the most random times in the drift, or, you know, somebody, you know, does a huge mend and ends up moving the indicator 3 feet, and the indicator after that shoots under real quick, and it's like, oh, there's still fish. There's bugs coming off. They're hungry. They're going to eat. But I think the biggest thing you learn on the South Platte, and I've seen it, you know, if you can dial your skill set into the South Platte, because it is a very pressured and technical fishery, you know, you really can have success anywhere you go.
I always feel lucky for that, because I really, that's where I really started fishing, fly fishing, you know, and I've always been on rivers. I really learned to read water and kind of learn where fish were from my father and spin fishing as a kid, but fly fishing itself, you know, and I had a guy that I went with and he was like a mentor, and, you know, it was hard, man. I mean, I just had so many skunks on the South Platte, like, I mean, just a lot of them. And it was all me, you know, I would go with other people that were catching fish, you know, and they would try and help me. But, I think it's cool too. Like you mentioned way earlier, that, you know, you were teaching your friends when you were younger. And I think it's something that I didn't realize, but you know, it's not that hard to be a mentor to somebody else in fly fishing. You just have to have a little bit more experience than them, you know, like you don't have to have so much more. You just have to know a little bit more than them, or it's like a workout partner, somebody to go with, to take you. And he knows just a little bit more about good form or whatever, you know?
Right. Well, I mean, and even still, I learned things from, you know, I learned things from clients that have never held a fly rod before, right? Just they might do something with how they're holding their rod or how they're going to move their rod when they mend. And, you know, it's not a sport that I think, you know everything. Like you never hit a point where you're like, you know everything. So you constantly have to be learning and, you know, willing to learn more than anything.
You got to set the ego aside. I think it helps a lot, you know, with learning and with teaching, you know.
Absolutely.
What are some of your biggest victories on the South Platte as a teacher, as somebody that's, you know, because I view you as someone who's not just catching fish for people, but who's helping people, you know, who's teaching people how to progress.
Yeah.
Based on your love of progress and your love of teaching and things like that.
Yeah. I'm certainly not the guy that's gonna, you know, cast and set the hook and here's the rod kind of guy for you. I don't think people learn by me doing that. So I'd much rather watch them learn and progress on, you know, progress throughout the day, making little victories here and there, and whether it's, you know, adjusting their cast or their presentation. But I mean, I think, you know, some of the things this summer, especially, you know, I had a lot of trips with really young kids this year, you know, 8 to maybe 7 to like 11.
What's too young?
I don't have an answer for that, because I don't think there is a too young. It is 100% dependent on the kid, because I will have a 7-year-old who will get out there, and whether he's catching fish or not, is listening to everything I have to say and doing everything exactly what he's supposed to do, you know, that his physical limitations allow, just because of how old or how strong they are. And then I'll have, you know, 12 or 13 year olds that don't want to do anything but be on Snapchat all day. And
Or 45 year olds.
So, you know, I don't really have it too young, but, you know, getting to watch these young kids get out and do it from start to finish, the cast, the hook set, you know, there's times when, you know, they'll hook a really good, strong fish and they can't even, you know, they need to reel. I don't want to reel for them. So I'll just kind of give their rod a little bit of little extra hand support there because they could barely hold on to it. And, you know, watching them do that, those are always victories for me. I love watching that and being a part of that.
Yeah, my son hooked up. I was at Decker's, I don't know, last summer. My son hooked a, he's six, I think he was six at the time, but it was a, he hooked a nice fish. I knew it was a nice fish, and as soon as the rod just leveled, you know, just like straight down, and his little arms, like, it was gone pretty quick. It's a tough, but man, he was excited, you know, he was pumped, and he still talks about like, oh, remember when we almost caught that fish, you know? So I think that's really cool. Do you have any folks that you've taken out that you've seen progress in fly fishing over those 14 years that now are involved in paying it forward or teaching other people or things like that?
You know, as far as that goes, I don't really have anyone who's been, you know, turned from like client to guide or anything like that. But, I have, one of my favorite clients. He's a great guy. And I, you know, he's brought his son out a couple times as well. And, I think we've been fishing together. We've been fishing together maybe only 3 or 4 years now, but, and I've got so many awesome clients that I've fished with over the years and fished with every year, that have all progressed. But I mean, just this guy is just a sponge. I mean, and he really does just take in everything, and every single trip we do, it's better and better. And then he goes and, you know, he goes on his own days and, works on techniques that we've done. And, you know, every time he texts me, oh, Phil, I tried this and, you know, it worked awesome. I'm like, that's so cool. I'm super pumped for them because, you know, that's the ultimate goal is to teach and, you know, make people better anglers. You know, especially those that want to become better anglers. You know, as a guide, you certainly have those people that are in Colorado and they want to, you know, they're rafting one day and they're fly fishing one day. And, but I mean, that being said too, some of those people that I started out where it was just kind of a day filler for them are now awesome clients, and they've come a long way to the point where it's not even me so much, you know, you obviously add little tidbits of instruction here and there, but it's almost turned into, you know, pointing, there's a fish, and all right, he puts it on that fish. So, oh, I see. Nice. Lays a cast on that fish, hooks the fish, we land the fish, you know. So in those days are awesome because
high five.
Yeah, exactly. All right, let's do it again. And that's kind of, you know, I've got a lot of guys that are like that, to where, you know, it's, I kind of just get to go around and look and point at fish and, you know, watch them do the work. So it's pretty cool.
Yeah. Well, especially if you're part of the journey for that person, you know, to get them to that point where now it's at that level. Last question on the South Platte real quick, but if you could only fish it 2 days, which 2 days would you fish it? You only get two. How would you fish it, and which days of the year would you go?
I don't know that I want to give away my two favorite days. It's going to be there.
That's a fair answer. It's a unique answer, but I will accept it. That's good. All right. Next topic. I'm serious. Next topic. So, I know that you enjoy chasing large brown trout. We talked a little bit about them before. I want to know how does a day begin when you're going to go try and catch a large brown trout? Is it a mental shift, or is it just, I'm going fishing today and I hope that I, you know, catch a, you know, I'm targeting a big brown or something like that. Is it something that you prepare for, or is it just something that, yeah, kind of I'm out fishing and this is what's happening?
Yeah. For me, it definitely can be. I mean, you know, for me, large brown trout, they are a different breed, right? They are not, you know, they're not rainbows or cutthroats or brook trout. They are the wariest, I think, of all the trout. And, so if you're going to go target large browns, for me, I do kind of mentally prepare that it's not going to be a numbers day. You know, we might find some fish, or I might find some fish, you know, on the way, or, you know, some that were willing to, eat what I'm throwing at them. But, you know, whether it's nymphing or dry fly fishing or casting streamers all day, it's my tactics. I'm aware that my tactics will be a little bit different, for where I'm going to be targeting these fish and how I'm going to be targeting those fish. So
how are you changing it up, or what changes do you make?
Well, brown trout more than any, especially during the daylight hours. I mean, they're very well known that they're nocturnal feeders. So getting them to eat during the daylight hours is also, especially large fish, is even more of a challenge. So you are going to be targeting those, you know, a lot more structure. You're going to be targeting deeper water. And that being said too, even during the summer, you can absolutely find those big fish in riffles. But they're not going to be super visible. Or if they're there, they're going to be well hidden. They're going to be next to something, you know, whether it be a big weed patch or a boulder mid riffle. Very rarely is there, at least in, and you know, I'm coming at this from our pressured tailwaters here in Colorado. I'm not talking about, you know,
That's fair.
These rivers in New Zealand where, you know, you see them walk up and, oh, look at that fish in the middle of the riffle up there kind of thing. And, you know, believe me, I want to go do that really, really bad. You know, so I'm more looking at this from what I have to target them in. So in our local waters or waters that I go target these big fish, it's a little bit more of just kind of being aware of where I'm going to be fishing. And, you know, there might be, you know, 10 rainbows up there feeding hard off of a shelf and, you know, or sipping dries. I think actually, to be honest, my best example was from a guide trip this spring. I was on the Arkansas River tailwater down in Pueblo, which if people don't know, man, it is, I think it gets a bad stigma because Pueblo is kind of looked down upon as a town in Colorado, is whatever. I don't, and it's just kind of, you know.
I like that Arkansas. I fished it a couple times, but
yeah,
I did okay.
The fishery though, in my opinion, is one of the top rainbow trout fisheries in the state. But there are some incredibly big brown trout down there, as well. They just have an incredible forage base between, you know, the rainbows being stocked, the small rainbows that are naturally reproducing, the sucker population, crayfish, you know, it's pretty incredible. There's an abundance of leeches and aquatic worms, and the hatch life down there is amazing. So there's so many bugs, but sorry,
that's okay.
Anyways, on a trip this spring, just a phenomenal blue wing olive hatch. I mean, every single fish in the river was looking up, sipping blue wing dries. I mean, you know, my client, we got a 24, 26, and like a 23 inch bow all on dries, and they're just eating. It looked like when fish get on trikes and they turn into that stupid mode where they really are just kind of sipping all those spent spinners.
It looks like it's just raining. Like if it's not raining.
Yeah, it was phenomenal. But I walked to the top of the run and I looked down into the run, and sure enough, there's, you know, a 25, 26 inch brown hanging on the bottom. You know, it was eating aggressively, you know, but it was eating submerged.
Is it always submerged? Like when you're going over these big browns, if you're in that mode, if you're in that mindset, do you have to be subsurface, or should you be primarily subsurface?
You don't. I mean, I always say you don't. I mean, in these big browns, and again, this is all seasonal as well. Browns will absolutely come up to eat drugs. Yeah. You know, I've caught them on hoppers, PMDs, stones, you know, salmon flies. It's very seasonal on that, but this is just kind of comparing browns to all the other, you know, including big rainbows, and the behavior that I was witnessing is, you know, this fish was chowing down, but it was all, you know, subsurface stuff. Which again, you know, and during that season, it's a pressured time on the Arc tailwater, during the spring season there. So, you know, whether it's by design that, he didn't want to be seen, or, you know, was just more wary in general. You know, watching that fish do that when every other fish, when you have 26 inch rainbows sipping blue wings on the surface, was really an eye opener. You know, and he was close to structure as well. Again, he was really close to structure. So
that's the thing that I've noticed, and I have not even a fraction of your experience, but anytime that I've caught a big brown that I can think of, it's or when I imagine a big brown is in some water, it's always like hard to get to. It's always like that's going to be a tough cast. That's going to be tricky.
Right.
It's really deep off a shelf or something. I have to wait it or cast far enough up and it's got to get down quick, or, you know, there's tons of debris around the bank, or it's right up against the rock, or, you know, it's just a tricky little seam that comes around something that's just going to make it hard to make it natural. And when I've seen them, especially in Colorado, cause you can see so well up deckers or something, like I'll be like, yeah, that's a beautiful trout, but I just, there's no way I'm not even gonna waste my time. I can't get to it. And even if I could get to it where I'm casting from, I could never land it. Like I can't get to a place where I'm going to land that trout, cause I'm on this giant boulder and
right.
can't lift it out of the water, you know? So I mean, I don't know if that's anything that you've experienced, but I've always, not always, but that's something that I've noticed when,
yeah. Like I said, I mean, whether they're rising or, you know, on the dream, we do get fish coming up to eat, you know, you do get browns to come up and eat dries and during the summer months, and, you know, whether it's trichos or PMDs, and, you know, you'll find them in the riffles and you'll find them in deep runs. But the one constant that I find is whether they're, you know, in a shallow riffle or wherever they are, structure is close by, right? Yeah. If they're in a shallow riffle, there's usually a large weed bed close by that the fish can go and tuck underneath. Or there's a rock close by that they can go and tuck underneath, or there's deep water, you know, 5 feet below them that they just turn and go right back down to. So, you know, just realizing that they are so much more structure oriented, and almost more self-aware of their surroundings and where they feel safe is kind of,
that was kind of part of my next question. Do you think that they have, like, I had a guest on earlier, they called it the program, but do they have like a thing they do? Like I got a hook in my mouth and now I'm going to do this, that I'm going to go over to the rock, or I'm going to dive down into that hole. Or do you think that they habit patterns kind of thing?
I do, because I think that's their, I mean, even without being hooked, that's where they want to go when they feel
threatened,
nervous or threatened. Yeah. Exactly. Right. Yeah. Like if, whether you hook them or not, that fish is going to go to that rock or under that log or in that deep water. So yeah, I definitely think that they are well aware of their, getaway strategy.
What goes through your mind when you hook up with a big brown, as far as fighting it and landing it? Anything different, or you just go back to basics?
Just tension, really, just making sure that I probably just black out and just go into autopilot, to be honest.
What just happened?
Yeah, exactly. You know, it's,
oh, that's a fair answer.
When I do take note, like, especially if I'm sight fishing to a large brown, I do take note of where that fish is likely to go, or obstacles that could be a problem, and try to, before I even make my presentation, try to develop a strategy for, okay, what happens if he goes here? What happens if he goes there? What's my best, you know, path of action to kind of get to where I'm going to need to be? You know, if that fish runs downstream and starts to go around that rock, I know I can't cross the river down there. Am I going to have to cross here? You know, what am I going to do with that log there? So I'm kind of, you know, I'm kind of always taking note as to the obstacles already, and just trying to kind of figure out if I can, where I can try to steer them from here and there. And
yeah.
So
do you fish a different rig at all? Do you set your, anything different with what gear you're fishing with or anything for a day where you're saying, yeah, I might catch less fish, but I'm going for browns.
Big browns. Not really. Sometimes flies I will. I'll change my flies. I'll, you know, browns can be very hatch specific, but they also, because they are, you know, big time predators, and because they do a lot of their feeding at night, I do find that nymphing is, I believe nymphing will find more large trout than any other method.
Yeah.
You know, it's not saying, oh, well, you know,
not 100% of the time.
Big streamers. Well, yes, yeah. Big fish eat big streamers. You throw big streamers, you get to catch big fish. My argument to that is, if you don't put your big streamer in front of that big brown when that big brown is willing and willing to chase and eat a big meal, you will not catch that fish, because you're not gonna.
Right.
They don't just eat everything that goes by. I mean, they could have eaten a mouse the night before, or a vole, or, you know, a 10-inch trout. You don't know, so they're not necessarily always going to be willing to eat a streamer. Whereas, you know, they don't have to do any work if a nymph drifts into their face. Yeah. All they have to do is open up. Okay, that was cool. Oh, you know what I mean? It's just a different. That's how I view it. As far as,
yeah,
as that goes.
You're still nymphing mostly.
Nymphing and streamers. I do throw a lot of streamers, and in the summertime, I'm throwing hoppers, because that's what I like to fish in the summer, and that's what I'd rather catch a big fish on. And yeah. You know, so then in that case, I'm throwing hoppers at undercut banks and stuff like that. So
what's your biggest brown trout got away story? The one that got away. They're always a little bit.
The biggest one that got away, was that the one, the biggest one that got away. I'm fortunate. I was able to land the biggest one I've ever hooked. So, the biggest one that got away was actually this summer. We did have some really high water, or a period of higher water on the Dream. And me and my buddy were walking down the river, and I almost walked right past it. I thought it was just a giant patch of grass. And then it moved, and I was like, you know, it was kind of that oh shit moment. Oh my God, look at that thing. I fished that fish for probably 30 minutes, just watching him eat, you know, move up and down in the column. And he's just happy as can be. And I finally hooked him. And as soon as I hooked him, you know, one big quick head shake, and he shot down into some of the structure that had been placed down below. And I was, you know, fishing, I think 4X that day. There was no chance I was stopping that fish, or I was, whatever that fish wanted to do, he was going to do. So,
did you set up on him and fish a lot of flies to him, or you said 30 minutes? So
yeah, I
30 minutes of constant casting, or,
yeah, you know, are you kind of, yeah, I mean, cause he was eating the whole time. It's not like I needed to rest him where I had spooked him. He was happy as could be. I just wasn't giving him, you know, I had to figure out what exactly he wanted, and, you know, so we threw leeches and worms and, you know, for big stuff, see if he wanted big stuff. He didn't want big stuff. So he, you know, went to smaller stuff, little stones, PMDs, caddis. I think he finally ate a caddis. So,
on the top, a caddis?
No, he wasn't rising. He was, just moving up and down in the water column. So,
anything else you want to talk about why you like, chasing big trout, or how you like to fish to him? I know you mentioned a little bit about, you know, flows changing the river, but anything else that you want to bring up?
Biggest thing, you know, the biggest thing when it comes for me and fishing those, or trying to catch big browns, is I really look at it as a paying your dues, type of fishing. You know, you don't go catch a giant brown every day you go out looking for them. I mean, that's just part of it. Cause you know, they hide, they're, you know, selective. You can't always find them, and it's, you know, so it's something that you're going to pay your dues, doing, but, you know, if you stick to the process, I like to say, you know, and kind of stick with what works and what you believe, it kind of, you know, it pays dividends with some truly giant fish. So.
Sounds good. Ready to change topics?
Yeah, let's do it.
I want to talk about your book, man. Fly Fisher's Guide to Colorado's Easy Access Mountain Lakes.
Yeah. It's super pumped. Came out this July, and yeah, it's a super cool book. I was when my publisher kind of came to me with the idea, I was a little bit uneasy, just with the original concept of doing a guidebook for high mountain lakes. You know, there's so many guys out there that, you know, they'll pick a blue dot on Google Earth and they'll hike to it and find out if there's fish, and you know, that's work that they've put in. And so I really wanted to make sure that I didn't, you know, put any of these, you know, crazy long hikes, but awesome.
Yeah. Awesome,
some spots, you know,
spot burning. Is that what
I felt like it was kind of a fine line and a difficult balance to kind of find there. But, so I set my parameters, especially since they wanted it to be, you know, an easy access title.
Easy access? Was that part of the deal, or
it was that? Yeah. So, and that's where,
I think that's super interesting, and I think it's cool too.
Yeah. Well, and so, yeah, like my parameters were, it's basically lakes in Colorado here that you can drive right up to a round trip, like roughly 6 mile hike. So okay. 3 in, 3 out, you know, which there's nothing secret on those, right? It's more of a collection of, I think it's close to 70, and there's 68 lakes. And I didn't, you know, touch on, you know, the big reservoirs like Spinney Reservoir, 11 Mile Reservoir, stuff like that. It's more of these smaller lakes. But it's got everything that, you know, if you've got a family and, you know, you want to drive up to these beautiful settings and catch brook trout and brown trout, you know, all day, you can do that. It's got a couple more that are a little bit more advanced, you know, some of those lakes that you hike in. It's a kind of somewhat strenuous, you know, 3 miles. But it's cool, and you can go find some big brook trout. And then plenty of everything else in between, right? So I felt it was a pretty good balance of, you know, everything that I was looking for, without, you know, giving away the farm kind of thing. So
have you fished most of them or all of them?
Yeah, I fished all of them. I've fished all of them. Wow. To be honest, I think I had sent my manuscript in a year ago in August. The final manuscript and all the images. So for the previous year and a half, I had to go back to all these lakes after my guide trips to try to take pictures, you know, that's a big piece of fly fishing books is, you know, the first thing you look at in a book when you pick it up in a store is you flip through it and be like, oh, look at the pictures. Right. So that was something really important to me, but because they are high mountain lakes, it's a limited season. You know, some of them aren't even thawed out until the middle of June, and then they'll start to freeze over again October, or are frozen even by now. So trying to accomplish getting all those photos and images during a busy guide season was a bit challenging, and it was made for a tired summer for sure. So
how was the writing process? Was it same thing? I mean, do you have to write before and after, or what was your, this is a selfish Jason.
Yeah.
Writer so question.
For me, the writing, you know, I, because I had been to all these lakes before, I already had, you know, a good bit of idea on what I was going to write about and how I was going to talk about them. And a lot of the book as well, it's kind of anecdotal evidence, somewhat like stories of what worked, you know, without saying go to this lake, cast this fly, you'll catch this kind of fish. I feel with guidebooks, it can't just be that, because it'll be a 68 sentence, you know, it'll be 68 cents for 68 lakes kind of book. So
be kind of boring too, because every lake would have the same paragraph, right? It'd be like,
Right. So, you know, getting to, you know, rather than just saying, oh, on the hike, this is what the hike does, you know, being a little bit more descriptive in the hike, you know, my personal kind of experiences going there, you know, times when I went there when it didn't fish well, times when I went back and it did fish well, things that I figured out between kind of different outings, really, I think paints the picture of how to have success at all these different lakes. But as far as like going through the writing process, it was things that I had experienced before. And then I obviously didn't just walk to these lakes and just take a picture and leave. Like I fished them for a while in the afternoon. Yeah. I mean, for a late day, but that was okay. And then I'd go back and I would either add or subtract or edit and just kind of, add a little bit of bulk to what needs to be said or needed to be included for each lake. So
sounds like it's not just a, where are they? It's more of a where, how to kind of book or a combination kind of.
Exactly. Yeah. It definitely talks about, you know, it definitely talks about different tactics and techniques for each lake, discusses the species of each lake. This discusses for those that are hikes or that include a hike, you know, discusses the hike and what the hike entails. You know, there's one of the lakes on Independence Pass. It's only a half mile hike, but it's like straight up. So, you know, I have it in there, but I do include that it is a more strenuous hike and that it is, you know, it's a tough one to get to, but you know, there's some big brook trout up there. So, it's got a little bit of everything as far as that goes, tactics, techniques, locations, like I said, discussing about the hike, you know, great spot for families and all that good stuff. So
what similarities did you find when you're looking at all these lakes? Was there themes or threads that were similar, or were they all just like unique gems of,
and that's, you know, that's one of the challenges in a book like this as well. And is that because they're all high mountain lakes, you know, a lot of them are very similar. But they're obviously not the same. The lakes in the Grand Mesa, for example, in Western Colorado are incredibly scud rich lakes. That's a huge staple part of those trout's diet there and those fish's diet. And I mean, scuds are a diet everywhere for high mountain lakes, but, you know, to see it be so dense to where you could pick up weeds in your hand and have scuds crawling all over your hand, was different than maybe some of the lakes in the Collegiate Peaks where, you know, there's scuds there, but, you know, maybe not, as densely populated. So
like regional kind of similarities. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's
right. Cool. And then, you know, the differences in, you know, fish species, you know, like just, it's kind of, the book is broken down into regions. So it's got like Southwest Colorado, Western Colorado, the Front Range. So a really cool facet of it is it does discuss the different cutthroat, where we have the Rio Grande cutthroat in Southwest Colorado, the Colorado River cutthroat out west, and the Colorado River drainage. And then the Greenback cutthroat here on the Front Range. So pretty cool when it talks about that. And so regulations and stuff. So
how'd you get into writing? Was that something you studied in school, or why did you say, you know what, I'm going to write a book?
Cause yeah. So
second book, right?
Yeah. So I guess there it's, when I was a little kid, I used to write books, like staple pieces of, you know, paper together and fold it up and just make little silly stories and, write books doing that. And
not so silly now.
Now I know. Right. And then, kind of just, I've always enjoyed writing. And then I think more than anything, I hit my stride while I was in college as far as writing goes. Cause I was a history major. So I, a lot of history papers, being written for 4 years. And, so I like to think that while I don't use my degree directly, all those papers have kind of helped me with my writing and,
No doubt, for sure.
Yeah, and I was super fortunate in 2011. I started working as a contributor with American Angler magazine up until 2019 when they kind of stopped doing their printed issues. So, Yeah. And then as far as this book goes, my publisher, they really liked my writing style and my photography, and reached out and asked if I'd be interested in doing this project. And yeah, we talked about it for a bit and came up and sounded like it was a good plan. So.
Well, that's awesome, man. I'm excited for you. And
yeah, thank you.
Anything else you want to share about the book?
It's like I said, I think it's just an awesome resource for people looking to, get into high mountain lakes fishing. It does cover tactics and techniques. And like I said, it's got stuff for pretty much the whole family as far as, lakes in Colorado goes. As I mentioned, you can drive up to some, some of those ones you can drive right up to are really heavily stocked. So it's really cool. You can go, cast an elk hair caddis or a big old parachute Adams and have fish eating your fly all day. If you're, your little one doesn't fly fish, but they want to throw their Snoopy pole out there, they're going to catch fish too. I mean, that's important.
Super important,
right? Like, yeah. So, there's options like that. And then, like I said, you've got these super cool, a little bit tougher hikes in there that lead to some bigger fish as well. And everywhere you go in on any of these lakes, they're all surrounded by, beautiful settings. So,
yeah, for
it's
sure.
It's a pretty neat book. I'm really excited with how it came out. Yeah. So,
well, the thing that just struck me as you're talking about that, I had a person on that was introduced to saltwater fly fishing and got into photography and just started taking photos, started exploring the ocean, but not even that far, just right offshore or right in these places, sort of like easy access kind of places to go. And, it strikes me with your book, it's something that like, it's right there. Like it's, you look at the mountains from afar and it's like, oh, those are the mountains, but it doesn't take much to just get to some of these places that you're describing that are so beautiful and that you can take your kids to, and you don't have to have a super, you don't have to have super experience or any of that. If you're willing to put in just a little bit of effort, read the book, check out some of these places, you can really get closer to that. So I think that's what's cool to me about making it the easy access part, or something that it's not so distant or far away. Does that make sense? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, definitely.
So, all right, man. Before I ask you my last question, how can people find out more about you, buy a book, get a guide trip, or find out more about what Phil's up to?
Yeah, so you can always kind of visit my website. It's philterellaflyfishing.com. And then I guide exclusively with Angler's Covey in Colorado Springs, Colorado. And their website, I think, is anglerscovey.com as well. So philterellaflyfishing.com or anglerscovey.com. And then I believe the book, as with everything going on right now, supply chain issues, I believe we've got that figured out. It was on Amazon for, I think a week or two until we figured out that, Amazon had put it up as a dress, like a garment dress. So we're trying to get that figured out, and that's kind of been a little bit of a nightmare trying to get the.
Well, I was going to say in the beginning, are you worried that the book will be mistaken as a dress based on the title?
Possibly. You never know.
I'm just kidding. That is really weird, dude.
Like, yeah, it'll get taken care of, and it'll be up. You can also, I know you can order the books from Angler's Covey as well. So,
I noticed also there's a great article at anglerscovey.com about you and your history and kind of about more information about the book if people are interested as well.
Yeah. Yeah. We did a little blog and pretty much talked just about the book for a while. So if you have any questions on that, but yeah, feel free if you have any questions, if anyone has any questions, they can, I think my emails and everything is on my website. So philterellaflyfishing.com. Yeah. So.
All right. We'll link to all those things in the show notes. Last question for you, Phil.
Yeah.
If you could go back to when you first started fly fishing and give yourself two pieces of advice, one more tactical, one one piece of advice, more philosophical, what would you tell yourself to help you progress as a fly fisher?
Tactically, if I could go back, if I could go tell 10-year-old Phil,
that's what I'm talking about.
Yep. If I could go tell 10-year-old Phil, I'd say exactly what I tell my clients now. I'd say, slow down, roll cast, you know, just slow down. The reason you're getting tangled is because your stuff's in the air way too much. So,
okay.
That'd probably be, if I could talk to young me again, that'd be one. And then philosophically, I'd guess I'd just say, you know, just enjoy every day, like truly just enjoy every day. Cause at some point they're going to run out. You know, and I've had health issues in past years that I'm super fortunate. I'm doing great now, but, you know, you never know when yeah. your last cast is going to come. And, you know, I really hope it's not for a long, long time, but you know, it's, just enjoy every moment that you have on the water. Whether you get a tangle or whether you lose a fish, just enjoy it as part of the experience and, you know, move on and enjoy the next part after that. So, I guess that's probably my biggest philosophical.
I think that's a really good one, man. There's no guarantees in this life, right? So
that's right.
I really appreciate you saying that, man. And I appreciate you taking the time to talk, and I'm grateful for you to be on the show. And I wish you luck with the book and everything else that you're doing out there, and look forward to book number 3 at some point, hopefully. So thanks, Phil. Appreciate it.
No, Jason, thank you so much for having me on. I really appreciate you inviting me, and feel honored to be on your podcast here. And it's a great conversation here. Love talking fly fishing. So, yeah, best of luck with everything moving forward on your end as well. I love seeing what you're doing, and, I'll be sure to keep listening in.
Thanks for listening to the Wade Out There Fly Fishing Podcast. You can learn more about some of the topics we discussed in today's episode show notes. For more fly fishing ideas, stories, and artwork, check out my blog and online gallery at wadeoutthere.com. If you want to make Wade Out There a part of your own fly fishing journey, please subscribe and share. Until next time, Wade Out There.